Chapter 16. Jane Hawk can't have shot out traffic cams at every significant intersection across the county. If Jason Drucklow has to do it the hard way, he can check video archives for major area intersections like Wilshire and Santa Monica Boulevards, as well as those for the nearer freeway entrance ramps, looking for Randall Larkin's S600 Mercedes, though this is a time-consuming process. Better yet, with the back door into their system that certain people at the National Security Agency have provided him, he is able to access license plate recognition data that is collected by police cars and other government vehicles equipped with 360-degree plate reading systems. The automated readings are transmitted 24/7 to a central archive. All he has to do is enter the plate number from Larkin's S600 and specify a time block, say from 7 o'clock a.m. to 8 o'clock a.m. If the Mercedes happens to have passed a plate reader, and most likely it will have passed more than one, he will be told the precise location and time at which the recognition occurred, whether the car was stopped or in motion, and in which direction it was headed, although its ultimate destination will remain a puzzle to be solved. Best of all, with the license plate number, which he already possesses, Jason is able to pull from the DMV a vehicle registration number. With that, he obtains from a cross-referenced registry the unique transponder code that allows the Mercedes to be identified from orbit by the network of satellites that serves its GPS. Just then, Cammie Newton returns, having stopped at Jason's favorite bakery after completing her assignment in the alleyway behind the lawyer's office. "Carb insanity," she declares, flipping open the lid of the bakery box and displaying both sugary morning rolls and beignets, his favorites.
"I'm about to find the Mercedes,"
Jason says, as focused on the computer as any gloss-eyed granny riveted to a Vegas slot machine. Cammie puts a morning roll on one of the napkins provided by the bakery and quietly places it on the desk, within reach of Jason's right hand. She doesn't at once take a pastry for herself, but sits in the other office chair and watches him with childlike adoration. Sometimes Jason is embarrassed by the veneration with which Cammie regards him, and most of the time he is conscious of the fact that he does not deserve to be so revered. But at all times, he is delighted to be the object of her hero worship.
"Long Beach," he announces. "The car is in Long Beach, near the harbor."
"Cool,"
Cammie says.
"In a minute, I'll have a precise location."
"Bitchin'," Cammie says. "You are the bomb."
"Not really."
"No, you are. You are the bomb."
"Well, maybe a little bomb."
"You are the bomb," Cammie insists.
"Boom,"
he says, and she laughs, as he knew she would. Chapter 17. Randy, in the grip of revelation. As he spills what he knows about DJ Michael to this self-righteous bitch, a new light dawns across the landscape of his mind, and an excitement builds in him that he conceals from her. His revelation is that the confederacy of elites behind this conspiracy will fail, will be exposed and either brought to justice or slaughtered by outraged and terrified mobs who will revolt with such fury that the savage and bloody French Revolution will seem to be a genteel transition of power. To this point, Randy has been an ardent believer in the plans of these people, who call themselves techno-Arcadians, who intend to create a world of plenty and total peace through the application of total control. But he is no longer one of them. For now, he sees. He sees. He sees that techno-Arcadia will never be built, that everyone from DJ Michael to the lowest minion involved in the scheme will face ruin and death. Everyone but him. Randall Larkin will skate and live and prosper, because in one morning he has been cast down from on high by, of all people, this hot-looking slut who ought to be sitting in a suite in Aspasia, waiting for the next visitor to show her what total submission means. Therefore, he has been awakened from his delusions in time to survive what fate awaits the other Techno-Arcadians. He is not nearly as rich as DJ, but he is smarter than the billionaire, smarter than any Arcadian he's met, smarter than these smartest of all people. So if he could be reduced to this, so will they be, because smart isn't enough. You've got to have luck, too. Luck doesn't favor the smart. It doesn't favor anyone. Luck can overturn the most clever plans of the smartest people. If this half-smart piece of tail, Jane Hawk, can take down the likes of Randall Walker Larkin, it is sheerest folly to suppose that total peace through total control will in fact come to pass. He has 20 million in a super-secret account on Grand Cayman Island, and the means to hire a private jet to get him to those warm climes tomorrow. On another Caribbean island, he has an estate owned by a trust that cannot be traced to him. Not least of all, he has 12 of the new generation of nanomachine control mechanisms in a secure cold storage facility. When DJ is brought down hard and the conspiracy implodes, when all of the others are either in prison or dead, Randall Larkin, under the name Ormond Heimdall, can guarantee himself a life surrounded by the most loyal and submissive servants and bodyguards. From black despair, he rises now to the hope of resurrection, and he sells out DJ to the furthest extent of which he is able. The half-smart rat queen bitch with her pen and notebook jots down what seems important, and before Randy finishes, he reveals one more place where DJ sometimes goes to ground. He tells her half the truth of Iron Furnace, enough to entice her, leaving out one crucial detail. That one thing she doesn't know might be the death of her. Although she has saved Randy by opening his eyes to the role that luck will surely play in the downfall of the Techno-Arcadians, he wants her to suffer and die, because, after all, she has robbed him of his dream of a world of peace. And a man's dreams are sacred to him. Chapter 18. In the light of the screen of his second computer and the love glow of Cammy Newton, Jason scrolls the map down county to the city of Long Beach, magnifies the harbor area, scans eastward, and there discovers the GPS locator of Larkin's Mercedes. Although he has full trust in the technology, he thinks there is a mistake, for the map places the car in the Los Angeles River, south of Anaheim Street. To verify this unlikely location, Jason returns to his primary computer, once more using the NSA's program that allows real-time and archival study of all traffic and venue cameras installed by local, state, and federal agencies. There's a Riverwatch camera associated with the Anaheim Street overpass, from which he is able to get a clear view south toward the harbor.
"Holy moly!" Cammy exclaims. "Will you look at that!"
A black Mercedes, half submerged, has shoaled up against the support structure of the bridge that carries State Highway 7 over the Los Angeles River. It bobs and wallows in the racing water. A fire department rescue team is on the bridge, two or three vehicles, emergency beacons flashing. Chapter 19. In his crisis, Larkin did not rise to the heights of courage, nor did he display the less lofty, passive courage called fortitude, nor was he able to sustain the mildest resolution to resist. When he decided to wash away his co-conspirators, he did so not with a slow and steady stream of details about DJ Michael's residences, but instead opened like a fire hose, backed by hydrant pressure, gushing information at such a velocity and volume that Jane Hawke needed to resort to shorthand to capture useful details in her notebook. His pale face took color from the thrill of turning traitor, cheeks flushed even in the bleaching light of the gas lantern. The fear sweat skinning his face dried up. If Jane could still read him in this state of manic surrender, Randy was buoyed from despair to relief, and his eyes shone with a kind of glee. As if he had long wanted to escape the pressure of being DJ Michael's consigliere, and found this forced betrayal to be liberating. When she had the information that she needed, quicker than she had expected to obtain it, she returned her pen and notebook to her handbag and got up from her chair and stared down at him, not with contempt, for he was beneath contempt, and certainly not with pity. She supposed that by the most stringent code of honor she owed him, not mercy, but perhaps clemency. He sat there with a somewhat strained but not uncertain smile, sure that he could trust her to keep her promise.
"I'm starving. That damn stuff you made me drink. I'm shaking with hunger."
Indeed, he might be past his worst fear. He believed she would show him the path to a future, as she had said she would, for he knew that promises meant something to her, even if the promises he made to others meant nothing to him. Turning from him, she took her handbag to the table and put it down, and stood staring at the four bowls with which she'd threatened to feed the doctored water to the rats. After a silence, he said,
"What are you doing?"
The soft serpent hiss of the lantern, the white light as cold in color as vapor rising off dry ice, the gray radiance of the high windows, like the sad memory of light from a first world long lost by human iniquity, the gathered darkness all around, and speaking to the heart in the silent language with which darkness always spoke.
"You promised me,"
Larkin said, as if to remind her that among people of honor there were lines that could not be crossed.
"You said you'd show me a path to a future."
She picked up a full bottle of water and turned it in her hand and said, "This is the brand I bought when we lived in Virginia, when Nick was alive, and we were talking about maybe a second child." His voice quavered.
"I told you everything you needed. I'm not your enemy anymore. I'm finished. I've nowhere to go. All I have is you gave me your word."
"Nick cut his throat," she said. "Cut it deep with his K-bar knife. Severed the carotid artery." She turned the bottle around and around in her hand. "I found him drenched in blood." Behind her, Randall Larkin said,
"Not the rats."
Chapter 20. Cammy attends the police band radio, seeking some word about the situation with the river-hammered Mercedes grinding against the supports of the bridge. At his computer, Jason leaves the real-time shot of the bridge and returns to the NSA archives. He moves to a camera upriver at the Interstate 405 overpass and reverses video, traveling back in time, alert for the moment when the swept-away S-600 appears on its north-to-south journey. Rolling her chair to Jason's side, Cammy reports, "From what I hear, the first responders say there's no one in the Mercedes." Jason is not so sure.
"Unless Larkin's body is in the trunk."
"My man," Cammy declares, "you are always a step ahead."
"My job. But on second thought, I doubt she'd kidnap him and right away kill him."
"Why not?"
"If her purpose was to kill him, she'd have done it in the alleyway behind his office."
"There it is,"
Cammy cries, pointing at the screen and then clapping her hands with delight at the sight of the river-borne Mercedes being turned and churned by currents. Because Jason is reversing video, the black sedan rocks and wallows upriver toward the 405 bridge, which it apparently passed under earlier. By this strategy, he moves north and further back in time, to cameras offering a river view wherever he can find them, to Del Amo Boulevard, to Highway 91, to Artesia Boulevard, Alondra Boulevard, Rosecrans Avenue. Again and again, he finds the S-600 at different points on its rollicking progress.
"Call Marshal Ackerman at Volunteers for a Better Tomorrow," Jason says, referencing the nonprofit that employs him and has some important connection with the NSA. "Tell him that Jane Hawk evidently abducted Larkin. She ditched his car in the river, and I'll soon be able to tell him where she was when she ditched it."
"Why would that matter?" Cammy wondered.
"Because, sugar, she might still be there with Larkin."
Chapter 21.
"Not the rats," Larkin repeated. "Not the rats."
As though it was a mantra with which he could alter Jane's intentions, in much the way that a nanomachine control mechanism worked its will on the brain of one possessed. Jane turned from the table, the bottle of water in her hand, and regarded her captive. He pulled against his bonds with such determination, straining upward with arms and legs, that it almost seemed as if he might, by sheer will, levitate and ascend out of the susurrant lantern light into the gloom overhead. She said, "The only bottle spiked with appetite stimulant was the one you drank from. The other three are just water." In the lantern glow, his khaki eyes shone almost yellow, like the eyes of some feral cat.
"Then you never intended?"
She put the bottle on the table.
"The rats."
"No. But you needed to believe I would." From the handbag, she removed a pair of scissors. She went to him, aware that his relief stiffened into wariness at the sight of those blades. The cutting edges were sharp, but she had to work the jaws of the scissors to saw through the stubborn zip tie and release his left arm. A sob of gratitude escaped Larkin as Jane dropped the scissors in his lap and said, "Free yourself." She stood by the table, watching him as he cut the tie that bound his left arm, and then went to work on those that secured his ankles to the chair. He gave no thought to attacking her with the scissors, but dropped them on the floor and rose shakily to his feet. He appeared cramped and fatigued, as if he had been bound much longer than was in fact the case. Nevertheless, she drew the Colt 45 and held it at her side.
"You promised me a way out of this, a path to a life," he said in a tone of condemnation, as if he served now as the voice of her conscience.
"You don't need me for that. You already have a path prepared, Randy."
"What are you talking about?"
From an inner sport coat pocket, Jane withdrew a passport. "A life as Ormond Heimdall." He reached into his suit coat, as if he could not believe the passport she held was the one he'd been carrying. "Do you keep this with you all the time?" she wondered. "Every day? Everywhere you go? Do you sleep with it close at hand? How long have you been so worried that things were going to fall apart?" He reached for his wallet, found it missing. "Of course I searched you before binding you to the chair. 10 C-notes in your wallet, in addition to smaller bills. Your own credit cards, plus, in a separate compartment, an American Express card in the name of Ormond Heimdall, which probably has a very high limit." Chapter 22. After Cammy explained the situation to Marshal Ackerman of Volunteers for a Better Tomorrow, he said that he would prepare a crew to snatch Randall Larkin back from his kidnapper, and then would stand by for a follow-up call, telling him where the attorney and his captor might be found. For long minutes, Jason was unable to locate the river-tossed Mercedes in the video archives. He went to cameras as far north as Slauson Avenue, near Bell Gardens, before he realized his error. He had stayed with the Los Angeles River Channel, But the Rio Hondo, angling out of the northeast from El Monte, merged with the Los Angeles east of Downey and north of Hollydale. He went to the junction of those two rivers and, moving back in video time, quickly found the sedan rafting down the Rio Hondo.
"You're the bomb," Cammy declared.
"Boom," he said, and laughed,
and began to track the S-600 toward the point from which it had been launched on the waves. Chapter 23.
"Just give me the passport, the wallet. They're mine," Randall Larkin wheedled. "Okay? Just give me them. Haven't you tormented me enough already? What's the point of this?"
Beyond this thing that called itself a man, high in the farther darkness, the west windows received less light than the east windows behind Jane, paired like the eyes of some jury of colossal presences whose pale, blank gaze attested to the moral blindness of justice on the earth.
"Anyway," Larkin said, "you've won. You didn't have to come after me. You don't have to go after DJ. You have those flash drives with all of Bertold Schenck's research, the history of the control mechanisms. Dump it on the internet. Blow it all wide open in a day."
"Most people don't understand," she said. "But I do. And I'm sure you do."
"Understand what?"
"Laws that seemed to be about making the internet more fair, making it more democratic and open. Woven through them are levers with which government agencies can control what's seen. They can identify impermissible information, even as it's being uploaded. Begin editing it during its initial distribution, before it's drawn any attention. And not just edit, but also insert misinformation to discredit the whole package. They, your people, salted everywhere." Larkin didn't deny her allegation, sought only to assure her that their filters were not as efficient as she supposed.
"It's not that easy. We can't respond that fast. You've got Schenck's flash drives. You don't need me."
"Your people in all these agencies," she continued, "have installed tripwires throughout the entire web. When the name Bertold Schenck appears in the context of words like control and mechanism and slavery, when the name Aspasia appears in relation to words like submissive and phrases like incapable of disobedience, alarms will go off. Suppression of the information will begin within minutes." She put the passport on the table, and his gaze fastened on it. "The days of the Wild West Internet are over," she said. "If something appears on the web, no matter how damaging it seems to be to those in power, they want it there for one purpose or another. Because they've tampered with it, can pop it, deflate it, whenever it suits them. Because it intimidates their enemies. Whatever." Larkin looked up from the passport.
"There are a whole lot fewer Arcadians than there are other people in all those agencies. They aren't all powerful."
From the handbag on the table, she took his wallet and placed it with the passport. She said, "I see, Mr. Heimdall, that you're a citizen of the Commonwealth of the Bahamas. Once in the Caribbean, you're a stone's throw from the British West Indies, so you must have quite a stash and a secret account on Grand Cayman."
"I don't have anything more to give you. What more do you want from me? There is no more."
"You can't be Randall Larkin any longer. Your own kind will gut you. If you can't be Ormond Heimdall, who could you be?"
"I don't have another life set up. Only that one."
"If you can't be Ormond Heimdall, who could you be?"
"Nobody. Is that what you want me to say? Nobody."
"What if you don't have the 1,000 in your wallet? Credit cards, millions in a bank on Grand Cayman. Then what do you have?"
"Nothing." "You just want to hear me say it. I'd have nothing."
"If you had nothing, what would you be? His horror was equal to his anger equal to his fear, and only those three emotions in him, as he stood there like some failed prototype of a human being made from clay lacking essential ingredients. What would you be? She repeated. He considered the pistol in her hand, at her side, and then he met her eyes again.
Nothing.
Without money and power, you don't know how to be anything.
You enjoy breaking men, grinding them to dust.
Not all men, she said. Not most. Just the likes of you. Chapter 24. Jason finds video shot upriver from where the Mercedes was launched down a long embankment and over the channel wall.
Call Ackerman, he says, as Cammy Newton thrills to the sight of the luxury sedan airborne as in some chase movie.
He makes note of the coordinates of the camera and estimates the distance from there to the place where the car shot into sight through what might have been a chain-link fence. Even at a distance, he sees an industrial building that might be related to the fence, a structure perhaps twice as tall as others in the neighborhood. Not 2 minutes later, Cammy has Marshall Ackerman on the line again from Volunteers for a Better Tomorrow, waiting for Jason as he continues his quest through Google Earth. He finds what might be the building, resolves the satellite image to maximum magnification, and after a quick study, shifts to Google Street View. He does a 360 to discover a place zoned for industry that has fled to other states or countries, sprung and cratered pavement, the grim sight of a slow cataclysm, rust and rot.
I think this is it, he says.
He thinks this is it,
Cammy tells Marshall Ackerman. Jason recites an address, and Cammy repeats it to Ackerman, and Ackerman hangs up, no doubt at once joining men who wait, heavily armed and eager, in vehicles with the engines running. Jason snares a beignet from the bakery box. Cammy snatches up a morning roll, and they toast each other, bumping pastries together.
Sweet,
she declares. Chapter 25. Larkin knew not what to do. Standing in the lantern glow, pale and expensively disheveled, like some king in ancient times, no longer of the flesh, denied entrance through both the front and back doors to the realm of spirits, and yet too proud to haunt this world that he once ruled. Sakura Hannafin dies hornet-stung and suffocating as her airway swells shut, Jane said. And my Nick, like a marionette, manipulated. And some schoolteacher out in Minnesota immolates herself and others because a computer model says this is how to build a better world. And you should just fly to the Bahamas and live out your life in sun and splendor? She picked up the passport and the wallet and put them in the handbag that stood on the table. Larkin said nothing, was nothing, and could say nothing but what he had said before.
You promised me a path to life.
And there it is, she said, pointing to the door through which earlier she had rolled him on a cart. Learn the streets and how to live on them. Steal a supermarket cart and find your treasures in 100 dumpsters.
I can't live that way.
Many do.
There's no way I can hide from these people, from DJ. They'll find me in a homeless shelter as easy as in my favorite restaurant.
Then go home to your wife.
Her? She'll know what's happened the moment she sees me, that I've sold them out. She'll be on the phone to DJ in a minute.
Jane said nothing.
I beg you. All right, I beg you. The passport, the wallet.
Again, she pointed to the door.
You can't imagine what they'll do to me. You can't imagine.
No pleasure abided in this for her, No warming of the heart by revenge. No sense that she was balancing the scales of justice. She knew only a loneliness as might have been felt by the sole survivor of a shipwreck, adrift on a flotsam of deck boards and fractured cargo crates, under a sky empty of all but the sun, the surrounding sea emptier still. In a voice shorn not only of hope, but also of despair, a voice dead to all emotion except, perhaps, existential dread, Larkin said,
I'm no good with pain. I won't let them do things to me. If I rush you now, you'll have to shoot me.
Jane raised the pistol, sans silencer, from her side, and took it in a two-hand grip. Leave this place.
You're not cruel, he said. You won't shoot to wound. You won't leave me crazy with pain.
She made no further promises. He retreated to the essence that defined him, to the role of smug, elitist prig, a sneer contouring his face as he said,
You're dead already, you piece of shit. They'll all know about you in the whispering room.
He came at her, and she squeezed the trigger twice, the first round taking him in the throat, staggering him backward, the second a headshot, his features deforming into a grotesque countenance, as if to preview the face that he would wear in a deep other world, ablaze with fire that produced no light. As his head snapped back, his suit coat flared wing-like, and he dropped as a bird, shotgunned from the sky, will drop, collapsing in a graceless, splay-legged posture in the cheap aluminum and nylon webbing chair that he would never have allowed to uglify the patio of the house in Beverly Hills, where now his widow waited. Chapter 26. Big and black and unmarked SUVs, windows tinted, battery-powered emergency swivels clamped in place between window glass and doorframe, flashing red and blue, oscillating sirens cutting the air with a sound as sharp as sword blades. They race, one close behind the other, three in all, carrying a strike force of 12 men. They demand the road through neighborhoods where motorists pull out of the way in respect of authority, and then through communities where pedestrians and people sitting on stoops fade at the siren sound and seem never to have been there. They kill the sirens for the last 2 miles, making way with just the roar of engines and the stutter of tires shuddering across broken pavement. Marshall Ackerman sits front passenger in the lead vehicle, wearing a Kevlar vest over jeans and sweater, holding in his lap a pistol converted aftermarket to fully automatic with a 20-round magazine. Two spare magazines are sleeved in his utility belt. If they can take Hawk by surprise and alive, they will. But if they kill her, there will be no penalty or grief. Likewise, Randall Larkin. They slow and coast to the curb and stop half a block from the Target building, a mid-century example of spiritless architecture, secular temple to industry, its god having long abandoned the place, corrugated walls warped and mortar weather-leached from between its concrete blocks. If the front gate is locked, they will scale the fence, but the padlock shackle has been cut. The chain is easily unwound from the gatepost. The gate rolls aside with a minimum of rattling and clinking, and the 12 enter, fanning out to surround the factory. Both ends of the long building feature roll-up truck doors as well as man-sized doors. Logic makes the case that she would have parked the Mercedes behind the factory, out of sight of the street, before shepherding Randall Larkin inside, if, in fact, that is what she did, before sending the sedan on a river cruise. The three team leaders coordinate in murmured words, with hands-free earpiece walkie-talkies. There will be no danger from friendly crossfire. Ackerman himself is second across the threshold, everyone in his team moving low and fast and spreading out at once on entering the cavernous space. A moment to grasp what lies before them. more than a football field length of heavy shadows layered to total darkness in some places. Just this side of the 50-yard line, a sphere of light fading outward from what appears to be a gas lantern. Barrels, all manner of trash, an empty patio chair, and one not empty. Although his head is cast back and his face not visible, there is no doubt that the man in the chair is dead, his posture too limp even for a sleeper. Warily, they move closer, until the blood on his shirt and suit confirm his condition. And now the face turned toward the ceiling, entry wound just above the bridge of the nose, features somewhat deformed by the overpressure of the detonation, but still recognizable as Randall Larkin. With Larkin dead, Jane Hawk will be gone. They might have missed her by mere minutes. Marshall Ackerman speaks into the mic that curves down from his earpiece. "We're too late." In the wake of those three words, a low whoomp announces the detonation of an incendiary device and is followed by a thick gout of flame that dispels some of the farther darkness lying beyond the reach of the gas lantern light, illuminating big hillocks of paper trash, among other things. The fire fountains perhaps 20 feet into the air and then drops back and splashes outward, igniting all it touches. If Jane Hawk inadvertently left behind anything that could give them a lead on her, Ackerman and his men need to venture forward and grab what they can before the fire envelops it and the smoke blinds them. That intention is foiled when they are halted by the sight of low movement across the floor, what seems, for a moment, to be only seething shadows formed and flung by flickering fire, but turns out to be a horde of rats, whip-tailed and scarlet-eyed, fleeing nests now bursting into flames. As conflagrant forms of paper are whirled high and spin toward them on drafts born from the rapidly accelerating blaze, a flock of firebirds seeking nests of hair, Ackerman and his men wheel and run toward the open door, with rats scampering across shoes, clinging for a moment to pant legs, trampled and crushed underfoot. The men slip on what they do not wish to think about, pinwheeling their arms to keep their balance, loath to fall among the squeaking multitude in all its filth and flea-bitten frenzy. The men are less comrades than competitors as they collide and jostle at the narrow doorway, shoving at one another, coughing from their lungs the pale inhaled smoke, spitting out the taste of rodent waste as redolent on the air as the acrid fumes of burning things. Ackerman bursts from the churning smoke and into the morning light, among rats that stream across the weed-bristled blacktop in sun-blinded terror. Wheezing, he feels as if he has escaped death by a narrow margin. But though it is out of character for him to entertain such a thought, he also feels that the woman, with her incendiary device, has painted for them a foretelling of their fate. Chapter 27.
"You're dead already. They'll know all about you in the whispering room."
She had no idea what Randall Larkin meant by the whispering room. No point in dwelling on it. If there was a place they called the whispering room, she'd know it when she found it. The city bus growled through the late morning, seeming to be out of control when it gained any speed at all, lurching to the curb at each of the frequent stops, air brakes sighing as though with exasperation, wallowing back into traffic that didn't want to admit it. Less like a motor vehicle than like some hoven beast asserting privilege by virtue of its size. At her window seat, Jane Hawk kept her head turned away from anyone who chose to settle beside her, less concerned about being recognized by pedestrians than by someone face to face with her. She watched the sprawling city pass in fits and starts, its kaleidoscope of neighborhoods presenting ever-changing patterns, crowds bustling on errands that at the moment she could not to the least extent imagine. Nothing beyond the window seemed real to her. In the virtual reality that the world had become, only one truly real place existed. south of here, in rural Orange County, at the end of a lane flanked by live oaks, a modest white clapboard house with a deep veranda where her boy sheltered, safe with friends, two dogs alert to any threat. Although she hoped to be there to visit with him before this hateful day ended, she would not allow herself to count on the grace of a reunion prior to setting off to Iron Furnace in faraway Kentucky. She needed to see Travis, to hear his voice, to hold him in her arms. But what was needed in this life was not often what was given, and wishing for anything seemed to summon the demons that would prevent the fulfillment of the wish. She disembarked from the bus on Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills and walked south into the residential flats where she had encountered the two teenagers, Guns and Zizi. Her Ford Escape was where she'd left it. In the cargo space were two suitcases, the leather tote and the plastic bag full of wigs, everything as she had left it. She could not yet set out for Orange County and Travis. She would have an early lunch, and then a task awaited her in the San Gabriel Valley before her work here was, for a while, concluded. Chapter 28. When Lawrence Hannafin keeps his 2 o'clock appointment with Randall Larkin, he expects to find the secretary, Ellen, at her desk, where she has always been previously on his arrival. Instead, the reception lounge is unstaffed. The door to Larkin's suite stands open, and the rooms beyond lay quiet and shadowed. Puzzled, he sits beside a corner magazine table and chooses an issue of Vanity Fair, which had some years earlier published a long excerpt from one of his books. He flips through pages, preferring not to begin an article that he will surely be unable to finish. He is enjoying a photo spread of a young actress who knows the value of burying a generous amount of skin in the right publications when Carter Woodbine enters the lounge. Tall, white-haired, American, but as aristocratic in demeanor as any member of the British royal family, Woodbine does not venture down from the fourth floor except by elevator to the garage at the end of the day. Hannafin puts down the magazine and rises to his feet and says, "Mr. Woodbine," as the senior partner closes the door to the hall. "Mr. Hannafin, will you join me in Randall's office? I have some troubling news." Troubling is an understatement. In the privacy of Larkin's office, Hannafin learns that Larkin is dead, abducted by Jane Hawk, and almost surely shot by her after she flushed his Mercedes into a river swollen with recent rains.
"The fire was so intense, it will have left precious little of Randall," says Woodbine, "and it's not likely that the remains in the abandoned factory will soon be identified as his, if they ever are. In fact, we will ensure that they are never identified as his."
"But the Mercedes?"
"Was his, of course. We are in the process of inventing a story that we will coordinate with Mrs. Larkin. You may know Diamanta."
"Not well."
"Then you will want to spend a few hours in her company to get the flavor of her personality. We want you to craft the story we invent into a major newspaper piece."
"But what story?"
"Right now, we think he will have attempted to fake his suicide by sending his S-600 into the river. As a firm, we will reluctantly comment on the possibility that he stole millions from us."
"He stole millions from you?"
With a warm smile and a wave of his hand, Woodbine says, "Good heavens, no. We've financial controls that make that impossible. But Randall did have a Grand Cayman account that he thought no one knew about, in the name of Ormond Heimdall, with a current balance of 20 million. Eventually, it will be learned that, on this coming Monday, just 3 days after his disappearance, 18 million of that 20 was transferred into even murkier banking jurisdictions elsewhere in the world. You'll be given the details for your story."
Lawrence Hannafin knows that he is in rarefied company with Carter Woodbine, that his role here is to do what it has been said he will do, as if Woodbine is an oracle describing to him a future that the fates have set in stone. Yet he can't help asking,
why not go with the truth? Hang it on this damn Jane Hawk where the blame belongs.
This smile of Woodbine's is different from the other, more like that of a patient adult answering the question of a slow and naive child.
Miss Hawk has had quite a run of luck, but where it will soon run is out. We do not take her seriously. Meanwhile, we don't want this firm to be associated with her in the public's mind. We don't wish anyone to be wondering why a rogue FBI agent and a threat to national security should kidnap, torture, and murder one of the partners of Woodbine, Kravitz, Larkin, and Benedetto.
She tortured him?
Woodbine shrugs. One can only assume. Suddenly, Hannafin realizes that perhaps he is slow and naive, for it just then occurs to him that he might have somehow led the hawk bitch to Randall. Woodbine favors him with another smile that Hannafin can't interpret, though it chills him.
As soon as you know what you want me to write, I'll be on it. You won't be unhappy with the finished piece.
I know I won't, Woodbine agrees.
We have your numbers. Stand by for a call.
I will, Hannafin promises.
I'll stand by.
Woodbine graciously escorts him to the elevators and sends him to the garage, where he is parked in a stall marked client. He is somewhat surprised, but relieved, that no one is waiting for him. Although he had intended to have dinner out, Hannafin drives straight home so that he can be standing by. In the kitchen, he makes a large scotch on the rocks. As he carries it to his study, the ice clinks, and the scotch repeatedly slops to the lip of the tumbler, but he manages not to spill any. Sitting at his desk, after taking a long pull on the drink, as he puts the glass down, he does spill scotch, when he realizes that 6 silver-framed photographs of him and Sakura are arranged there. A few months after her death, a decent interval, he stored her damn collection of happy couple photographs in the living room sideboard. He thrusts to his feet and hurries to the living room. Other photographs have been distributed there in thoughtful arrangements on end tables across the fireplace mantel. His gun is in his bedroom, in a nightstand drawer. He rushes to the stairs, halts, stands there, looks toward the second floor. He almost calls out her name.
Jane Hawk?
But he does not do so, because he fears that she will answer. Chapter 29. In a library not far from Lawrence Hannafin's house, Jane sat at a workstation in the computer alcove and verified, as best she could, what Larkin had told her about Iron Furnace, Kentucky. Iron Furnace Lake Resort was owned by a private corporation, Terra Firma Enterprises, which held a portfolio of 6 jewel box hospitality business properties. Terra Firma was owned by Apoidia Trust, which had an address on Grand Cayman Island, a tax haven. The combined value of the 5 U.S. companies known to be owned by the Apoidia Trust, $2 billion. The director of the trust, an Englishman named Derek Lennox Haywood. People sufficiently interested to speculate about such things believed Apoidia was one of several trusts that oversaw the assets of David James Michael. Although a link between him and Apoidia couldn't be established beyond doubt, photos existed of DJ and Lennox Haywood together at charitable events in New York and London. The house that Larkin said was DJ's secret retreat, a 5-acre estate on Iron Furnace Lake, not far from the 5-star resort, was held by Apiculus, LLC. The owner of Apiculus was a corporation in Liechtenstein, about which she could find no information. On a hunch, She looked up the word Apoidea, the name of the superfamily that included hymenopterous insects such as honeybees and bumblebees, and apiculus meant a small, sharp point, such as a leaf tip or the stinger of a bee. She felt sure that in his desperation, Randall Larkin had told her the truth. Apoidea and apiculus seemed to confirm it. For whatever reason, perhaps a superstitious one, David James Michael tended to name things with words that began with the letter A. He called his inner circle of conspirators Arcadians, the hateful brothels staffed with girls whose minds had been scrubbed and then programmed was Aspasia, now Apoidea and Apiculus. However, confirming Larkin's claim that DJ could be found in the Iron Furnace house through the end of March wasn't a simple task. Unlike celebrities, people worth billions of dollars tended to guard their privacy. They couldn't be easily tracked by Star Spotter or similar services. DJ Michael was scheduled to attend a charity gala in Miami in May and a conference on climate change in England in June. Otherwise, as far as anyone knew, he would be spending the rest of the year snugged in a coffin containing a cool bed of soil from Transylvania. She put together search strings, trying to find any reference to his having been in Iron Furnace previously. Nada. As she was about to log off, she wondered if Bertold Schenck, the recently deceased scientist and Arcadian, partner with DJ in a company named Far Horizons, had ever spent time in Iron Furnace. Bingo. In March of the previous year, Schenck chaired a 4-day conference on the future medical applications of nanotechnology, sponsored by the Food and Drug Administration. By association, at least, DJ was tied to Iron Furnace. But she wished that she had more reason to believe the billionaire actually used the place as a secret retreat. She went to Google Earth and conducted a lookdown on the town and the resort as it had been when this database had been created. Having had a minute to consider that the FDA had sponsored Schenck's conference, she wondered if scoping out the estate owned by Apiculus LLC would trigger an alarm somewhere. DJ seemed to have allies in the security agencies, CIA, NSA, Homeland Security, as well as in the FBI. So perhaps they had done him the favor of putting this 5-acre property on a watch list, to be sure that everyone checking it out would be themselves checked out. She took a Kleenex from a coat pocket, tore off a piece, wet it with saliva, and pasted it over the computer's camera lens. Only then, she scanned farther on Lakeview Road and found a satellite shot of the target estate. When she tried to zero down on it, the magnification function failed to work. She went to Google Street View, cruised past the front entrance to the resort, and continued west on Lakeview Road. As she approached the Apiculus-owned estate, the computer screen blinked to gray. The camera function had been triggered from some remote location. If the lens hadn't been covered, a shoulders-up black silhouette of her would have been centered on the gray screen, and an Arcadian in one security agency or another would have had her photograph. She didn't take the time to log off. She killed the power to the workstation and got up and grabbed her handbag and exited the library and walked briskly 3 blocks to where she'd left her car. All the evidence putting DJ Michael in Iron Furnace was circumstantial. However, a preponderance of circumstantial evidence was sufficient to convict in a court of law, and everything supported Randall Larkin's claim that currently DJ would be found out there in Kentucky. Her next move was decided. Chapter 30. In the early Minnesota dark, Luther Tillman stood on his back steps, beyond the porch roof overhang. He was in shirt sleeves, with no coat, invigorated by the cold air. There was no aurora borealis, but the stars in their ceaseless nuclear reactions shone in multitudes, more stars than grains of sand on all the world's beaches, spanning countless light years and billions of calendar years, through an airless silence, until the farthest edge of the universe, where the last bright bodies poised on the brink of a void that the mind could not quite conceive. Considering this near infinity of suns and worlds and moons and mystery, the argument could be made that the life of one 40-year-old schoolteacher, never married and childless, at work in a largely rural county, did not count for much. What if her lovely stories had been put into print and sold millions of books? And what if she had not checked out with a horrific act of violence? Nevertheless, her life and influence would be but a few sweet notes in a symphony that already must be measured in thousands of millennia, leaving no more impression on the sea of time than would the single song of a robin. If any life was only of the most ephemeral importance, which was to say of no importance whatsoever, then all lives were without meaning, including those of presidents and movie stars and county sheriffs and the wives thereof and the children thereof. Likewise, no importance either could be accorded to the birds of the air, the beasts of field and forest, the creatures of the sea. There were those who lived by that philosophy, or pretended to themselves that they did. But Luther could neither live by it in truth or as a lie. Cora Gunderson hadn't merely done something terrible. Something terrible had first been done to her, and it mattered what that something might have been. When Luther returned to the kitchen and began to set the table for the dinner that Rebecca was cooking, she said, "I guess I know what it means when you stand coatless in the cold for half an hour, listening to the stars."
"Listening? Have I missed something? Have the stars started talking recently?"
She said, "They've always talked to you."
"Well, if they have, I'm not sure what they said tonight."
Turning from the cooktop, wooden spoon in hand, she favored him with her "do I know you or do I know you" look. "You mean you didn't hear them tell you to go to that place, that Iron Furnace Lake?"
"That's all the way to Kentucky,"
he said, as he folded paper napkins beside each plate. "So you,
what,
took a week off just to lay around the house?"
"I can lay around as well as anyone."
26 years married. Haven't seen you do it yet."
"Maybe not. But a man's got to start laying around sometime."
"Which won't be until you get back from Iron Furnace." He laughed and shook his head.
"You're a witchy woman, the way you read a man. Will it worry you too much if I go?"
Stirring the pot of brown gravy, she said, "What did I tell you about Twyla and college? Big city, small town, smaller town? These days, every place is as safe or unsafe as every other. You just keep in mind what you need to come home to."
"What I'm lucky that I have to come home to."
She said, "There you go." Chapter 31. Jane, on the road. The wheeled millions going and coming, more horsepower combined than all the horses that ever lived. Windshields in the northbound lanes burning orange with reflection, the light in the west not what it once was. Regardless of their beauty, sunsets raised in Jane the thought that the coming night might be the longest ever, with no morning beyond. Not just a personal death, but the entire world stilled in its turning. Her concern was more disquietude than fear, and had not always been with her. She wondered if she might be alone in this disquiet, or whether these days other people experienced it as well, and she suspected that all of them knew the feeling, whether they would admit it or not. Soon after nightfall, she would be with her child. If, in fact, all things of the earth that had been spooling out across uncounted centuries were soon to ravel up into nothing and be gone as if they had never been, she asked only that in the hour of final retraction, she should hold Travis in her arms and speak to him of her love.